Thank you, everybody, for sticking around on this. Is it still raining? It's rainy Friday. It's good to be in here anyway. My name is Rob Puentes. I'm with the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. As Charlie mentioned, he had a longstanding commitment, so he had to step out. So the Metro Program is actually co-sponsoring this great event with the with Charlie's Energy Security Initiative. We're very happy to do that. We're very happy to kick off the second half of the show here. I thought the first half was really outstanding. I thought the chairman's remarks were very interesting, very enlightening. I thought it raised a lot of key issues that were talked about there on the first panel. And boy, if there's one takeaway that I have, it's that, you know, the governance and the planning for these high transmission, these high priority transmission lines, is a challenge. It's definitely a challenge. And I think that the second panel will dig into now the distribution part of the energy grid. Also, I think probably going to see that it's also somewhat of a challenge. Fortunately, we've assembled a really great panel who's going to dig into this. Our moderator is going to be Lynn Kiesling. Lynn is a senior lecturer at the Department of Economics at Northwestern and in the social enterprise program at the Kellogg School there. She also is faculty member of the Northwestern Institute on Complex Systems and the Center for the Study of Industrial Organizations. Much more about Lynn and the rest of the panelists are in your bios, so I'll go ahead and turn it over to Lynn. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Careful. Hi, thank you. Thank you for that introduction and for inviting me to moderate this panel. I know this session is focusing on the distribution end of the electric power network, and I know we spend a lot of our time down in the policy weeds, and so a lot of our discussion here will involve some ideas for how better to get good outcomes and good results from the stuff that we do down in those weeds. Sorry, turning on my timer to make sure I don't try your patience. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you to step outside of the policymaking trenches and ask yourself a core question. And it's going to sound a little strange, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Is consumption or production the ultimate end of all industry and commerce? It's a big question. If the wording sounds archaic, that's because it's a question posed by Adam Smith in his Critique of Mercantilism within the 1776 book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations. Smith's answer to that was that consumption is the sole end and purpose of production, not the other way around. Consumption is the sole end and purpose of production. And his critique of mercantilism was that, in fact, mercantilist policies, by favoring particular producers and putting in place policies to favor those producers, reverse and cause unintended and intended consequences that actually reduce growth and reduce welfare and reduce well-being, particularly consumer well-being. And so I wanted to start with that kind of big picture framing. Because this remark really reminds us that despite the century-long focus on production and supply in this industry, and the economic and physical regulation thereof, consumption and consumers are still the ultimate end of commerce. And that's true in this industry as much as in any other industry. And now by that, I mean form, and I know from the tenor of some of the comments that we've already had that a lot of the issues that are bound up in this are environmental ones. So when I say consumption and consumers are the ultimate end of commerce, I think Adam Smith meant, and I certainly mean, form and not quantity. It doesn't mean the ultimate end of commerce is for us to buy more stuff and have more stuff, but to engage in the consumption of products and services that enable us to flourish and thrive. And if that means that I care very deeply about how my electricity is generated, then I'm going to buy green power. So it's not about quantity of consumption. It's about form and self-identity and self-meaning. Moreover, if you think about that broader question and the policy trenches we all live down in, the transformations that we've seen in our daily lives from communications technology have substantial implications for electricity consumers and consumption and the physical and economic structure of retail electricity markets. So notice that by framing this panel this way, I've broadened beyond just the physical distribution grid and the wires and the substations and the transformers, right? I'm encouraging you to think differently and think more broadly about the questions surrounding the distribution network as being ones that don't just involve the physical, how do we transport the electricity commodity from those who produce it to those who consume it, but more broadly, think about the digital communications technology revolution that we've seen of the past 30 years and the transformations we have had in our everyday lives and how different your life is today in terms of how much you can keep in touch with people, the types of transactions you engage in. You may not think of them as transactions, but they really are, especially those of you who have iPhones. And the potential for that to transform the electricity industry is similarly enormous, although it's hard to see in foresight, right? As in the 1970s, when nobody could imagine why anyone would want a telephone that you could have in your pocket while you walk around, right? Similarly, today, I think we don't necessarily see the potential value that the ubiquitous information, more individual transactive capabilities, that brings to us in this industry. But it also has broader institutional implications, particularly for the regulatory institutions that establish the context in which retail electricity markets form or don't, and the distribution of electricity to end-use consumers takes place. So these technological changes that are part of what we call smart grid definitely have implications for things like consumer protection and what does or should constitute what we have for the past century in this industry called regulation under the public interest. Because the potential here is one where we can have new products and services, new bundling. We can bundle, home energy management technology with home entertainment management technology all into one portal, and give customers a bundled product or service that they hadn't even imagined before was possible because they just think about electricity as I flip the switch and the light goes on. So the potential for new products and services and product differentiation and bundling, as well as new pricing and forms of dynamic pricing, is substantial. And that we should, while we are in the here and now policy, what are the policy activities we should be undertaking now, that we should keep in mind these longer, broader, potential value creation opportunities. But we also know that changing culture takes time, whether it's the culture within the regulated utility, within the regulators themselves, and within customers. So these are obviously incremental and iterative processes that we're talking about when we think about how does technological change transform the value propositions we can put to end-use consumers, and what are the business models and different ways that we in the industry are going to carry this forward. And to that end, one of the things that we're going to end on, because I think it's one of the most evocative, forward-looking examples that I'm going to plant the seed in your mind for right now, and then we'll come back to it, is think of the plug-in electric vehicle and how the plug-in electric vehicle is going to has the potential to transform our relationship with the consumption of electricity as end-use consumers. So that's a really, broad, enormous, huge framing for what are very important, necessary, detailed, sort of step-by-step incremental policy things that we are going to discuss on this panel. And hopefully we can integrate those two things. And we have a really superb panel of very distinguished speakers today. And I'm just going to introduce them quickly. And then, as Charlie did in the previous session, I have a question that is essentially targeted to each one, but open for what I hope will be a fairly fluid and organic conversation among us. To your far left, we have Jeff Ross, who's an executive vice president at GridPoint. Next to him is Cheryl Hines, who's the director of customer load and settlement at Baltimore Gas and Electric. And next we have Lisa Wood, who's executive director of the Institute for Electric Efficiency, at Edison Foundation. And my nearest right, your left, is Rick Morgan, who's a commissioner for the D.C. District of Columbia Public Utilities Commission. And with those as our panelists, I will start in with the first question that I have. And Cheryl is going to take the lead on this, and then we will toss it around. And the first question to the panelists is, what is the state's role in enabling demand management response and dynamic pricing, if any? Or I should say, I'm sorry, demand response management and dynamic pricing, if any. How should state regulators ensure that they coordinate their responses to real-time pricing strategies of companies that sell electricity in several states? There's a couple issues there. Cheryl.
Good morning. I am Cheryl Hines. I work for the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, which is an IOU, an investor-owned utility to the northeast of here. If you recall the map that was up when the chairman, Wellinghoff, was here, there was a little bubble over the middle Atlantic that said high stress right below that bubble, together with Washington, D.C., and our neighbors just to the north. So there is a lot of congestion in this area and some concerns about reliability. Well, at BGE, we've been doing a number of things over the years. We have a very long and strong legacy of demand-side management. In 1979, we had our curtailable program for very large customers. In 1988, a direct load control program, whereby customers with central air conditioners could get incentives if they allowed us to cycle their air conditioners. And we've been doing that continuously ever since. We've now upgraded that system to a more robust not only switches, but we have thermostats that are cycling the customer's air conditioners, taking advantage of their natural duty cycle and cycling on that basis. In addition to those programs, it was in January of 2007, we made a filing with our commission for our Smart Energy Savers program. This included a very large energy efficiency program, conservation, that is. It included the upgrade to our direct load control program. And finally, it included an AMI, Advanced Metering Infrastructure Program, which also included a dynamic pricing component. I had the pleasure of leading the dynamic pricing pilot in the summer of 2008 as well as 2009. We offered customers our standard rate, 14 cents per kWh, if they were able to reduce their consumption when notified a day in advance between the hours of 2 and 7, they could earn a rebate. So rather than just paying the 14 cents per kWh, they could earn a rebate of $1.16 or $1.75 for every kWh they were able to save. We offered another flavor of the program whereby customers, instead of paying the 14 cent rate, would normally pay on off-peak hours 9 cents per kWh. During that peak period from 2 to 7 on normal weekdays, they would pay the 14 cent rate, but on certain days when capacity is constrained and the prices are high, rather than paying 14 cents, they would pay $1.30. 14 cents, $1.30, or 9 cents. So we had those three different pricing scenarios going on in the summer of 2008. We had some pretty interesting results. I should back up a bit. The questions about what states can do. And one of the things that our state did in the form of our governor, Martin O'Malley, in 2007 is he challenged us with the Empower Maryland goals. That goal is to reduce energy consumption as well as demand, critical peak demand, or peak demand, by 15% by the year 2015. That's a rather aggressive goal. And our conservation programs do support that. We're not all the way to 15% yet, but we have plans of increasing as we get up closer to that time frame. So in addition to that statewide goal from our governor, we also have the Public Service Commission playing a role. And so far, they have given us the go-ahead for our conservation programs, for our new direct load control programs for the air conditioners. We're still working on the AMI and the dynamic pricing portion. And we actually have some hearings coming up in November that will help the commission decide on that basis. So what this, the state commissioners can then do, in our view, is to offer timely cost recovery for the cost of these initiatives. They can offer incentives that are appropriate should we reach the goals that are set and mutually agreed upon. And in the case of conservation, they can allow decoupling mechanisms that remove the direct link between the revenue and the amount of energy that is purchased. So those are three things that states can do now in the form of the regulatory. So back to our smart energy pricing, which you can see I'm rather invested in that program. We had a very interesting summer. Before that summer, we actually had focus groups of our customers, six different focus groups, to get a handle on what customers understood about pricing and electricity. And it was extremely varied. Customers understand conservation, but demand response and the price of producing electricity is not necessarily in the normal customer's mindset. So another thing that I think states and all of us need to do is get involved more with communication and education of our customers. We were able to do that using our focus groups as a platform and develop information so that customers could understand that at certain times here on the East Coast, it's on weekdays, it's when it's very hot in the summer, when we've exhausted all of the base load, the nuclear and the coal, and customers are still demanding more with their air conditioners, that the prices go up, and it's that those times when we need to send the price signal to customers to reduce. Well, I think they understood that because when we evaluated the results, working with the Brattle Group, did the econometric analysis, it showed some interesting things. We looked at 50 hours over the summer. This is 10 different days where the customers were asked to control a day in advance. They reduced their consumption between 18 and 33% on average, depending on what, whether or not they had a technology to help them, whether they had an orb glowing different colors to show them that this was a critical time. 18 to 33%. Now, at system peak conditions, which is the hour ending 5 p.m. at a certain temperature humidity index, 83 is that index, they actually saved even more, 22 to 37%. So customers were able to understand the information that we were giving them and work with us. We gave them hints on what to do to actually conserve, I should say reduce their peak demand. On the conservation end, though, it was interesting as well. The peak time rebate customers did conserve a modest amount of electricity. The customers who had that dynamic peak pricing, that high price component, $1.30, because they had that 9-cent off-peak rate, they actually used a little bit more. So we had a rather exciting time. We asked our customers what they thought of it. 93% were either satisfied or very satisfied. In fact, 62% were very satisfied. So we were rather pleased with that. 97% indicated that they would like to have the same rate structure in the following summer. So that's exactly what we did. We offered it again this summer. When asked whether these should be standard rates, 81% of the peak time rebate customers said yes. 70% of the dynamic peak pricing customers said yes. So we had a very interesting experience, and I'll just open it up for further discussion.
Okay. I'll just make a follow-up, comment to Cheryl's comment on her program in the context of what can states or policymakers do. I think one thing that we're seeing happening across the country is pilot programs like what BGE is doing, where they're going out with their residential and small commercial customers and offering these different kinds of dynamic pricing programs. And we're getting results that are similar to what Cheryl described in terms of very, you know, customers are responding a lot. So I think the important things for policymakers and for regulators are, one, to allow these things to happen, allow these experiments to happen, and allow mass market customers to start to see real price signals. Because again, we have a lot of different people in the audience, but in the electricity market, for many mass market customers, wholesale prices are really invisible. They're just getting a flat rate and really no awareness whatsoever what's happening in the wholesale market and whether you have huge constraints or extremely high prices. So I think that this sort of fostering these experiments around the country where we're allowing customers to see these prices and respond to them and have that experience and react and, you know, see what makes sense as the next step is critically important. The other thing I think that's happened in the Northeast that's been extremely positive is allowing both energy efficiency and demand response to be bid as a resource into the wholesale market. This makes tons of sense. It creates a huge incentive for utilities to go after demand response resources. And I think that's a great thing that's happened in PJM and in the New England wholesale market.
If I could comment from a regulator's perspective, I sure don't have anything different to say from what we've heard from Cheryl and Lisa. Indeed, the kinds of questions that we look at the DC Commission, I think this is true of other state commissions as well, is things like approving investments that utilities come to us seeking approval. Certainly the cost recovery issue is related to that. Of course, we have to subject it to a rigorous cost-benefit analysis. Typically, for something like advanced metering, a utility would need to do a business case and show that, in fact, the benefits exceed the cost. There are a lot of different ways to evaluate it. And in many cases, the benefits are amorphous. You can't always translate it all into dollars and cents. So we spend a lot of time sort of talking about some of the less quantifiable aspects of doing things like AMI and dynamic pricing. As Cheryl said, getting the incentives right is really critical. DC is looking at decoupling right now. We expect a decision very soon with respect to our electric utility. And then finally, the issue of pricing is really going to drive a lot of where we go in the future, in my opinion. If we continue just offering blended flat rates that charge the same rate 24/7, we're never going to get all the benefits of the smart grid, because so much of those benefits have to do with sending the right signal to customers about the value of their loads and the value of trying of modifying those loads. And if we go out and spend, in our case, you know, $60-some million on advanced metering, and then don't use those meters to send signals to customers and let them know right now you have an opportunity to save a whole bunch of money if you reduce your load because right now the system is under stress, then there's this huge amount of money on the table, and that customer is going to miss that opportunity. Not only that, when one customer reduces their peak, all the other customers benefit, certainly in this market, in PJM, because that brings down the market price for that hour for everybody. So there's this huge potential savings. And then finally, an answer to the last part of the question about what state regulators can do regionally. In this region, five of the state commissions from the original PJM footprint have gotten together through an organization called MADRI, the Mid-Atlantic Distributed Resources Initiative, which I was privileged to chair for its first couple of years. And it continues to be active, playing a role for dialogue, not just among the regulators, but we have invited the utilities, all the other stakeholders, the energy offices, the environmental agencies, to get together and talk about all the different kinds of benefits and opportunities that might come out of distributed resources, and that includes distributed generation, demand response, and energy efficiency. We've had a very productive dialogue. And frankly, the utilities, especially the ones that operate in multiple states, like Pepco Holdings, which is in four of the five states from the original PJM footprint, We were worried they might feel like we were ganging up on them. In fact, they were very happy to have us working together and talking to each other, because they would really like to be able to have the same kinds of policies in the different states. And the fact that D.C. is looking now at a decoupling mechanism that's very similar to the one that Maryland has already adopted is certainly something our utility is happy to see. So, and that dialogue continues. We have more meetings scheduled in the future, and they are open to the public. And if you want information about how to get on the mailing list for MADRI, let me know.
I'll just make a quick comment. I agree with everything that's been said up here. You know, it's, it's key for regulators really to give utilities the flexibility to do the types of programs that BG&E has done, allowing experimental rate structures, different programs that can be tried, especially on a pilot basis. Also think it's important, and Cheryl talked about this, and I think that's why the BG&E pilot was so successful. There's a big education component there. A lot of what has been done, if you look at the pilots that have been successful, have really involved large campaigns to educate customers and get them involved. Because to date, a lot of what's gone on is you get a bill at the end of the month, you open it up, that's the relationship you think about with utility. This is a whole new way to get customers involved. And I think ultimately the success really revolves around getting customers involved and getting them to participate in meaningful ways. The smart grid's really not an end, it's a means to the end, which is to get a more intelligent system, but a lot of that involves customer participation.
So I would, to hook back into my original comments, I would say the end is value creation, specifically consumer-focused and consumer-driven value creation. Is that consistent with?
Yeah, no,
okay.
Absolutely.
Good. I'm going to move on to our second prearranged question, and this one I'm going to direct to Lisa, and then we can open up for conversation. And that question is, how does the current utility rate design inform the development of smart grid policies at the state and national level?
Okay, I think we've touched on this a little bit already, but let me just sort of continue the conversation. That I just want to sort of put out a couple of numbers, because I think that the issue of the first of all, let me just say this. What does smart grid mean at the distribution level? We're talking basically about smart meters. So we're not talking about transmission or anything. We're just basically talking about smart meters. And what does that now enable for end-use consumers? Because it's all about the consumer, as Lynn started out the conversation. What can we do now that we couldn't do before with consumers? And we have, if you look across the country, we have over 58 million smart meters currently either being deployed or proposed or planned across the country that will be rolled out probably over the next 6-7 years. That's almost half of every U.S. household. So we will have a different country in 5 years, and it will enable a whole lot of things. Some we know and some we don't know, but it will change the landscape in terms of what we're able to do. So as Rick mentioned and earlier, I mean, for the most part, we still have across the country a lot of flat rates that are being offered to mass market customers, with very few exceptions, actually. And we do have these experiments going on. And as we start to see these 58 million meters being deployed, and this doesn't even count the DOE smart grid experiments that will be funded over the next 4 or 5 months, to the tune of $4.5 billion. And we'll see a lot more smart meters go out as a result of that. What are we doing with those meters? And what can we enable, customers to do? So, I mean, Rick sort of coined this line, so I'll give him credit for it. You've got to hang a smart rate on a smart meter. It makes no sense for us to spend all this money putting out smart meters, which are not cheap, to mass market customers, and not giving them options to either keep their current rate or go on to some other rate or do other things, with these smart meters, because we really don't even know all the kinds of things that might be possible. It's sort of just kind of the gateway, in a sense, to creating two-way communication with the customer. So I think that I'm just trying to go back to the question here. What in terms of rate design, or, you know, because we have all these meters being deployed, it's just going to create a lot of opportunities, and it's very important to allow those opportunities to happen, I guess, is what I would say at this point. I mean, we have not, you know, as was said earlier, the utility industry by and large has sent out a bill at the end of the month to consumers. You know, you consume some amount of electricity, you get a bill, you have no idea, you know, what caused what, unless you really take some time or run around with a meter and plug it into to different appliances or whatever. But all those things are changing. I mean, we have monitors now where people can look at, you know, how much energy is consumed. Kids can kind of figure out what it means to really turn the lights off. You can actually see fluctuations. When you do things, you might see how, you know, different rates might impact, you know, how much you're actually being billed for that electricity at any point during the day. So there's all kinds of opportunities that smart meters will really allow. And the smart meter, in my view, is really the building block to the smart grid, because in the end, it starts and ends with the consumer. I mean, we're creating electricity for consumers to be able to use electricity to do other things. So I think that we're just starting to see kind of some of the things that consumers will be able to do, and I think many other things will come along as other you know, entrepreneurs and other companies and jump into this business on the consumer side of the meter.
Jeff, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with GridPoint, but in your experience, what are some of those potential opportunities? What have you seen that consumers are likely to want to do with the information that they can get?
Sure. So, I mean, we've been involved in a limited number of pilots, but we've looked at a lot of the pilots. Just in 10 seconds background, at GridPoint, we provide a software solution for utilities to help them manage distributed energy assets more efficiently, and essentially be able to create almost virtual generation through those efficiencies. So we've been involved. Oh, is my mic
can
not?
Can you move your mic up, maybe?
Can you hear me now?
I don't think it's on.
Okay, I'll talk louder.
can we use this one?
That's it. Okay. Yeah. Use that for a sec. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay, great. Sorry about that. There's been obviously a number of pilots that have gone on around the country looking at things like dynamic pricing. And I think there's sort of two ways to look at it. On one hand, a lot of these pilots are focused on ways to use things like dynamic pricing, for example, to help manage load, help utility meet peak demand. And the things that deal with that on grid operations and reliability, I think, have an immediate benefit. I think the harder part to deal with is, and this is part of what Cheryl talked about earlier, when you think about energy efficiency and conservation programs, how do you design rates that both benefit consumers but allow the utility to still make a return comparable to what they would on assets that have been rate-based traditionally? And that's where I think we still have a little bit of a regulatory economic issue to work through, because I think in some instances we haven't seen as widespread adoption because we haven't been able to figure out how to provide the right incentives, particularly to investor-owned utilities yet, where, I mean, they can still, you know, be profitable and be deploying those types of energy efficiency and conservation programs.
I already touched on some of my thoughts about dynamic pricing, but let me add a point and respond to an allegation that actually I haven't heard today, but people may have heard it in other places about how dynamic prices may be very difficult and unacceptable to consumers, particularly low incomes, consumers, seniors, and so on, that many of these customers will not have the wherewithal to respond to price signals, and they certainly will not react well to a price of $1.30 per kilowatt hour, even if it's cheaper the rest of the time. But in fact, there are a number of reasons to believe that consumers really will benefit. For one thing, mm-hmm. the current flat rates, blended rates that we have now, are anything but equitable. That if you're charging customers the same price around the clock, The fact is, the power in the wholesale market costs more at sometimes than others, and the when you're paying for a blended rate, there's hidden within that price is a very substantial hedge premium, which is what the utility or your provider has to charge in order to guarantee you the same rate 24/7. And that has been estimated, that hedge premium, to be somewhere on the order of 15% and possibly more of your bill. And once we have widespread use of dynamic pricing, which of course also involves having widespread use of advanced meters, one of the benefits is the ability to design rates in a way that the customer can keep the benefit of that hedge premium that they're paying right now. The other thing is that low-income customers in particular tend to have more favorable load characteristics. Their loads tend to be less peaky on average than other customers, which means that right now they're likely to be subsidizing the larger customers. So a lot of these kind of reforms that we're talking about are really long overdue, in my view, and they add to the benefit side of the equation. Not that there aren't costs, and the cost of just installing AMI ubiquitously is still very substantial and really needs to be very carefully scrutinized by regulators. But it's important to understand some of these potential benefits.
And do you want to jump in, or are you? Can I go ahead?
I'd like to add a few things about our customers and their reactions. We talked about the fact that information is key. When we had our focus groups, customers said, and we had some low-income, specifically low-income focus groups, we really need these programs. We need to find ways to save. So we'll do whatever we can to save money. And in fact, they did. When we looked at some of our highest savers, one was a retired couple. I'm not sure what they did, but they must have, short of turning the circuit breaker, their consumption quite a bit when we asked them to. The other thing I'll say is that I think one of the reasons why our program was effective is we provided information to customers right after they saved. So every time we had a critical event, we summarized the customer's information, and we sent it to them within the week. So they were able to think back about what they did last Tuesday, for example, to save money and do the same thing next time or try to do even more. We included tips at the bottom of that information to show them ways to save, and they really responded.
So the immediacy of the information.
That's right.
Yeah. I wouldn't, as moderator, I wouldn't let Jeff give a plug for GridPoint, but I'll give a little plug for GridPoint. I did a demo with GridPoint a year ago. And I mention this because it really does encapsulate the comments and puts, at least plants the seed in your minds of what's next. You know, right now when we do infrastructure investment and thinking about the potential capabilities that smart grid infrastructure should have at the distribution level, future-proofing is the word you hear a lot when you work with the smart grid interoperability stuff. If you work in evolutionary biology, you think of it more in terms of allowing for exaptations, you know, future uses of the capability in ways that you couldn't necessarily initially foresee. But one of the things that in terms of future-proofing that I think we're all focusing on and thinking about as we're doing this is what happens down the road when we have embedded intelligence in appliances and we have fully transactive devices. So your water heater, your clothes dryer, your refrigerator, your coffee maker can be price responsive if you, the owner, choose to take advantage of that capability. And I mentioned the GridPoint demo because not only is there, you know, the potential for consumers in a very user-friendly way using the portals of companies like GridPoint to control and manage their own energy use in very simple kind of graphical ways that aren't, you know, if you can program your TiVo, you can do this. And programming your TiVo is easier than programming your VCR. VCR. I've lost all my antiquated technology knowledge. But one of the things that really struck me was, say, for example, you have solar panels on your home and that you have a capacity for it's a 2-kilowatt solar array on your home, and that you could choose as a homeowner to set a rule where if you're on a dynamic pricing rate and you have solar panels that, you know, as the day gets hotter and you've used up your capacity because you're running your air conditioner, you can set a rule to say, once I've used up the capacity of my solar arrays, then start powering down my appliances that are using electricity, you know, cycle off the condenser in my refrigerator and obviously turn up the temperature on my air conditioner. So you can as a customer, you can autonomously have your devices respond to balance your green gray mix. Yeah, and that's a potential that I found really striking in that demo. Lisa had mentioned that at the distribution level, sort of the key technology when we think about smart grid is the meter. As a lead into our next question, I will mention a couple of others, such as intelligence in the substation and transformers, autonomous digital switching, phaser measurement units. There are distribution devices we could use autonomously to make the distribution grid operate without as much human intervention and operate more reliably, because that becomes one of the really important questions. This is a question directed to Rick. Due to heavy consumption and long distance from energy sources, metro areas are prone to reliability problems. How can regulation be changed to allow for distributed generation, microgrids, and so forth in the metro areas that would relieve the pressure on the distribution network?
Well, here in the District of Columbia, we know what it means to be at the end of the wire. We import over 98% of our electricity, mostly from Maryland and to the north, which is really where our primary interconnections are. And also, we're about to lose our last two central generators, which are slated for retirement within a couple of years. And a few years ago, we got a painful reminder of how vulnerable the nation's capital is electrically. A local generator shut down very abruptly because of an environmental dispute, and thanks to DOE and especially Larry Mansueti, who spoke on the previous panel, we were able to keep the lights on through that crisis and eventually got a workaround with a new transmission line. At any rate, given these kinds of challenges, we're obviously very interested in exploring creative means of meeting the district's electricity needs, including non-traditional sources like distributed generation and microgrids. And these technologies are potentially valuable resources, but neither of them do we view as a panacea. We have to be very careful about integrating them into the distribution grid. They have potential liabilities as well as benefits. With DG, for example, it's possible to have too much behind the meter generation in the wrong places, and that could wind up being a burden on other customers. The size and location has to be matched with the system's needs, so it's very sort of case specific. With regard to microgrids, they can offer reliability and economic benefits to individual customers, but as a regulator, I have to make sure that the participants in the microgrid are not sponging off off the rest of the distribution system. So these things really need to be done very carefully on a case-by-case basis. In my view, the key to doing this well is to send the correct policy signals. You need to provide incentives for customers to pursue DG and microgrids where they provide value added to the distribution system, but not where they don't. And the best way to do that is through policies on things like small generation interconnection rules, net metering rules and tariffs, standby and supplemental tariffs, and we're in the process of working through all of those in D.C. right now. And all of them need to be fair and non-discriminatory, otherwise you wind up creating a problem with cross-subsidies and resulting inefficiencies. Ultimately, and you probably anticipated this, I think we need to move toward dynamic pricing rate structures that send customers a signal about the cost of their loads and the value of modifying those loads at any given time. And if we can get all these policies right, I think it will go a long way toward creating an economic climate where economic distributed generation and microgrids will come about, along with also economic demand response and plug-in electric vehicles and more energy efficiency as well.
We're all in violent agreement up here.
I'll make a further comment also. Just to follow up on what Rick was saying, from a reliability perspective, today, I mean, many utilities are using just simple load control programs as reliability programs. We're sending out a price signal to control air conditioners or water heaters. But the dynamic pricing programs are clearly another piece of the reliability puzzle and another lever, really, to pull in terms of keeping the grid reliable. There's lots of different possibilities. I mean, on the demand side, as well as on the supply side.
And I would add to that for some of our customers, about 22% of our customers do not have central air conditioners, and so they would not be able to take part in some of the direct load control programs that have been mentioned. But they can still reduce consumption during the 2-7 window, perhaps by changing their window units or taking other steps. I'd also like to emphasize the fact that these dynamic pricing programs that really allow customers to save money by using less electricity when it's most costly to produce, that these are very important and they're enabled by AMI. It simply would not be cost effective to have dynamic pricing without an AMI system. You could not deploy the kind of pilot that we deployed system-wide. It would not be cost-effective.
Yeah, I'll just add. I mean, I think the ultimate goal is to try to reach some level of grid parity for distributed generation and other resources. We're obviously a long way away from that, and to get there, we have to do a lot of work in terms of how we can optimize different asset classes and enable utilities to be able to do that very effectively. I think where we are today is, the utility has to be intimately involved in any of the technology selection and decisions about how, distributed generation or microgrids will be integrated and operate into the grid. I also think localities need to really be providing the right incentive structures, as Commissioner was talking about. And that's tricky today. I mean, you have places that have network grids like New York City where every time you want to put in solar PV, you've got to put in equipment up to $50,000 just so that it doesn't have a negative impact on that part of the grid. Other areas with radial grids, it's a little bit easier. But I think ultimately it'll come down to what are the right incentive structures for consumers and for the utility, and how do we set that environment? So, for consumers, I think we need, we talked about just a minute ago, net metering, I think is great to be pursuing. I think we need to look at tariff structures, everything from standby tariffs to, we're probably not ready for it everywhere, but discussion about feed-in tariffs and how that would encourage interconnection standards certainly still need work. So there's a lot of things there. I think for the utility as to how they look at that, I think further progress towards rate recovery on distributed generation assets, we're starting to see that now. It's not just something for customers. Utilities can participate in that as well. And obviously, there has to be the right interconnection from the utility standpoint in order for that to all make sense. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. What we're seeing, though, more and more of is just providing increased visibility to what's going on the edge of the grid is having a benefit both for, I think, the regulators, utilities, and customers to come together and have those conversations and begin to work those things out. And again, you know, in District of Columbia, we have a rebate program, and you see for solar, and you see similar type programs around the country. So things are starting to come together, but I think we still have a ways to go.
And we're going to stay with Jeff for our last question, which is the sort of take us forward. What's the effect of the plug-in electric vehicle likely to? How's that likely to transform our lives?
Sure. So that's a big question.
And I did deliberately frame it that way. Yes.
No, that's great. I think, you know, in the question you were talking about, what's the impact for consumers, for the distribution network, and then also for regulators? I think for consumers, it boils down to a couple things. First, you know, I think it's an opportunity to be participating in ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and do something positive for the challenge we all face around climate change. And electric vehicles certainly are a means to do that, and a very good means to do that. I would also say, you know, for customers, ultimately, it will be a way to save money. There's lots of studies out, but generally, I think it's accepted that the fuel costs are about one-fifth what they are for gasoline-powered vehicles. And so, particularly as we get further along in the deployment, I think there'll be lots of opportunities to see ways that customers can save money. The other piece I'll just throw out from the consumer side is, I don't know how many have driven PEVs, but they really are fun to drive.
Cool.
And I wouldn't diminish that point. I don't just mean the Tesla Roadsters and things, but when you drive one of these cars, they operate a lot more efficiently. There's less moving parts. They're lighter. The engines feel more powerful. I think it's we'll see consumer adoption in an unexpected area, and that I think consumers will want to drive them, not just because they're new, but because they also are responsive and perform well. I think for the distribution network, you know, one of the key things to think about here is it's going to be a localized effect. So if you look at how PHEVs have rolled out, what we've really seen is it tends to be very clustered. It's clustered not just in cities, but within cities in certain localities, and within localities even down to individual neighborhoods and streets. So, I mean, EPRI did a study on this to show that if you looked at the distribution of PHEVs and then the effect on feeders, particularly feeders for utilities, it's very, very concentrated. So this is a way of saying it's a very serious problem even early on. You shouldn't think of it as, let's see how many, you know, hundreds of thousands of electric vehicles we need operating and accessing the grid before we've got stress situations. It really can occur a lot earlier with just hundreds of vehicles in very localized areas. So I think that's one reason, and this is a bit of a self-plug, is with, you know, I will say GridPoint does work in this area, but really having smart charging capabilities is very important. And it's important for the utility because they've got to be able to manage the charging of electric vehicles as a load class, the same way they would look at, you know, different forms of generation, same way they would look at demand response programs. Some of the things we're more familiar with, really electric vehicles are going to come that another load class. The other piece is just from the regulatory perspective, I think we need to be thinking about new tariffs. And this goes beyond what I think we've traditionally sort of wrapped our head around in terms of dynamic pricing and even time of use pricing. I kind of like to think of it as a sort of a rate 2.0 approach that's a compact between the utility and the customer. And from the utility side, the customer needs to expect that vehicle owners will have very good certainty about how long it'll take to charge their vehicle, and have parameters by which they'll know when that vehicle is charged. I think from the consumer side, the consumers have to be willing to be much more active participants in what goes on with their vehicle. And again, because I think we're going to need to have smart charging down to locational specificity, that's very different from things that we've had today. So, for example, you could see smart charging programs between the utility and customers that certainly involve pricing signals.
I think even that involve emissions or greenhouse gas, climate change type signals, which is, you know, as a customer, I want to set my preferences so that I can charge with more renewable energy, or I can charge even when I know that the utility is going to be relying on gas, natural gas, as opposed to coal. So I think it gets more detailed than we have to date. Certainly the ability for a green power program to be able to have a tariff that allows me to access more renewable energy to charge my vehicle. And then simply a lot of concerns from the utility side, which is it needs to be an effective load management asset class, and so there needs to be signals for consumers to understand that and say, okay, I'm going to participate when the utility has, you know, an emergency, or match my tariff up with what the utility is going to need as well. And of course, there's all types of price implications for that. So it's an exciting new area. I think there's a lot of benefits for consumers, for utilities, for the environment. But I think a lot of these things still need to be worked out beyond just getting vehicles out there, getting charging station infrastructure out there, and just letting everybody have at it.
Again, we're in violent agreement. I actually put this question on the list, and the other thing that strikes me is it's there's a duality associated with the PEV. You know, everything in our century of experience with consuming electricity is very, you know, monodirectional. But once we have PEVs, not only do they consume electricity, but they can then become a network of distributed storage, right? Because that, you know, that electric vehicle is storing energy that could be used at some other time by someone other than you driving your car. Similarly, it makes you, the vehicle owner, potentially both a buyer and a seller. And for people who, you know, younger than I am, who have grown up both buying and selling on eBay, this is going to be natural. And having business models and having regulatory institutions that can accommodate that evolution and adapt to the technological change is going to be really important.
I was going to make that same point, but let me just add I know we're all saying the same thing here, this is a quote from the head of PJM, Terry Boston, who describes PHEVs as a match made in heaven with the electrical grid. And when you think of it as a storage device and not just a load, then you have this potential revenue stream coming out of the storage capability that makes it much more economical. And these things may actually become widespread a lot sooner than we think because of that value, once people recognize how they can be integrated within the grid. Even if you're using it to commute to work every day, it can still be a storage device whenever it's parked, and that's a tremendous value. That's not to minimize the challenges of the logistics of coming up with the charging stations and making sure that everybody doesn't charge them all at the same time or at times when you don't want them. But those are all things I'm confident that we'll be able to work out.
Cool. Let's open up to questions. So, yes, sir. The microphone's coming. And I would like to, because I know we're running a little short on time, so I would like to encourage you all to be brief and pithy in your questions.
Scott Rafferty, Area Group. I just had a couple detailed questions on the demand-side management programs. You mentioned that the $1.30 dynamic pricing, Cheryl, led people to consume more electricity, and that just seems very counterintuitive that you would obviously have a very strong incentive to avoid in peak, and people would actually invent new ways of using electricity in off-peak because of the incentive. And also, could you give us a little detail on what happened to their bills? Were there people in this population that had bill increases? And the other thing Lisa mentioned was that after you installed a smart meter, she was assuming there would be the option of continuing a flat rate policy. And I just wonder why, given the granularity of the investment decision, why you wouldn't try to target people who were enthusiastic about conserving energy, whether you might also have cooperative investment situations with homeowners to get really smart meters. Because the puzzle to me is, when I was at the Maryland Public Service Commission 20 years ago, we had a very painless and passive program to interrupt air conditioners 4 times a year with enormous incentives, we haven't really progressed very far from that. It seems there's a lot of scope to turn practically everything except the freezer and the TiVo off when you're not there. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you. I hope I can answer all your questions. You may have to remind me of them. If I skip something, let me know. I didn't mean to imply that moving forward, assuming we get commission approval with AMI and dynamic pricing, that we would have a flat rate. What we've actually proposed is a two-tiered time of use rate with a peak time rebate associated with it. And this is my own view, and I think it's shared by others at BGE. It's not a corporate position. In my view, customers may start with peak time rebate, but some customers may do better with a critical peak pricing program. For example, in our second summer, we had a customer who installed solar between the first summer and the second. They were not able to save much because their typical consumption was already very low under a peak time rebate. And so we'd like to be able to offer customers like that a dynamic peak pricing program. Back to the $1.30 rate, that was our dynamic peak pricing rate. Typically, the customer's rate is 14 cents. And that's the traditional rate that we have for most of our customers at BGE in 2008. For this particular group of customers, we kept that 14-cent rate during weekdays from 2 to 7 p.m., which is the on-peak price. We raised it to $1.30 on 12 days when we had a critical peak period, when the demand was higher than normal, pretty high. All of the other hours, except the hours of 2 to 7 on weekdays, they had an off-peak rate of 9 cents. So I believe that customers, we did see modest increases in consumption, and I believe it's because customers were using more during those 9-cent hours. And I'll indicate that's about 85% of the summer hours that they actually had a 9-cent rate rather than a 14-cent rate. So that's what we experience. Could we give customers incentives to try to get them to conserve all summer long? That would be our goal. And that would be our goal whether they're on peak time rebate or dynamic peak pricing. Did I leave something out? I'm not sure.
For that set of customers, was this a revenue positive?
Oh, yeah. So what about those customers? The rates were designed to be revenue neutral in that if customers did nothing, the typical customer should see the same rates. Not all customers are typical. For a few customers with the dynamic peak pricing, their rates actually did go up. It was a handful, I think maybe. Let's see, we had about 250 customers on that rate, and I think it was less than 10, their rates actually went up. So they were able, for the most part, to do something to reduce their rates.
Bill.
Scott.
Hi. Scott Bernstein, Center for Neighborhood Technology, Chicago, and we've been operating various kinds of real-time pricing experiments with residential customers and in two cases with whole communities for 6 years now. And I want to go back to Lynn's original framing, which I think didn't get quite enough attention, the Adam Smith question on consumption versus production. It seems what you're all saying is that I'm listening, Lynn. It seems that what you're all saying is that there's an opportunity here to turn all customers or all consumers into at least part-time producers. And secondly, on your locational point, there may be some good news in that. I mean, after all, if you want to relieve stress in an overloaded part of the system, you'd better target it. You don't want to spread your investments area-wide. So there's a community stake in this, too. And I wonder if perhaps the key to all this isn't the unbundling of the metering and the information function, a further unbundling. I mean, we've unbundled wires and generation. But without the unbundling of the metering, most customers don't know what they could have. They don't have information about their own distribution of consumption or their load profile, and they don't have the information about what's possible. I mean, could we imagine as a further evolution of all this, one that might make the smart grid take off in a hurry, sort of a massive opportunity disclosure here of what's there. After all, we're saving money. We're saving a lot of money for people in these things. In our particular experiment, we're outperforming the time of day kinds of pricing because we're giving people, you know, real-time prices, which change every half hour or so. And we're giving them early warning. We're giving them tomorrow's prices disclosed today so that they can look ahead. And what's really interesting is, as opposed to the autonomous stuff, we're actually getting higher participation and higher savings from the people who are paying attention. Now, maybe that's self-selection. I don't know. Walter Lippmann once said democracy means paying attention, and maybe that works in markets too. So what do people think about this sort of further evolution of the information function and giving people more choice and more opportunities to organize around this stuff?
There are a number of states that at least in principle allow unbundling. It's true here in the District of Columbia, but we haven't had any takers competitive metering is what we call it. I believe the same thing has happened in New York, where they've basically made an announcement that anybody who wants to go into the metering business can do it. Obviously, it would be important to set up rules in a way that make it competitively neutral. But I think one of the reasons is that it hasn't happened, and that doesn't mean it won't. But so far, there just hasn't been that much reason to do it because there isn't that much to be gained. Maybe once we start talking about more complicated metering and a smarter grid, there may be more opportunities, and maybe we'll eventually get there.
We have had competitive metering in Maryland since we had restructuring in 2000. To my knowledge, there haven't been very many participants or takers, but it could be because we don't currently have the kinds of rates that would support much, just as you said.
Chicken and egg.
I would just say, I don't know if competitive metering is the issue as much as competitive provision of information. And I think you are starting to see that. You're starting to see utilities offering different programs through the portal or information devices that can be placed in the home. You're starting to see large technology companies like Google and Microsoft and a whole group of startups offering products through the utility that'll do that, and some of them are actually offering direct to consumer. So I think we'll see evolution of that, and again, that ties into everything we've been talking about, which is really empowering the consumer with energy awareness and information, which then enables them to be a participant in this, and that's, I think we've all been saying that's critical.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Scott, I can interpret your comment as being an argument for retail competition where the consumer owns his or her own data.
Absolutely.
Oh.
It sounds to me, though, like Rick's saying, I could come in tomorrow and make a proposal to set up a metering.
So now you
feel
have
free.
A new business proposition. More
but
questions. There's a microphone coming your way.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could explain more exactly how does decoupling work. I understand the basic concept. The power companies are not paid on the amount of power that they're producing, but on something else. But what exactly is that something else? And if I understand correctly, Maryland already has it. So what is it that they're doing in Maryland, and what are they considering in D.C.?
Well, why don't I start, and Cheryl can talk specifically about Maryland. And it's not necessarily about the producing of energy. It's about how you charge for the throughput in the system. In our case, in D.C., our electric utility, Pepco, is a wires-only company. But they charge for delivering electricity to everyone. That's still a monopoly in D.C., and it's still a monopoly everywhere in the U.S., as far as I know, the distribution of electricity. And they charge per unit, usually per kilowatt hour, of electricity, and if you if the company sells less delivers less energy to the customer, they actually take a hit on their bottom line because that's less revenue for them, but they still have essentially the same fixed costs to cover. If you instead allow the per kilowatt hour rate to float a little bit, you can ensure that the company will take in exactly the correct amount of revenue, whatever the amount of revenue was that was approved by the commission, say, in the last rate case. And this is usually done on a per-customer basis. That's the way we're exploring it in D.C. I think that's how it's done in Maryland. Then what that does is it makes the utility indifferent to how much they sell. And the customer's rate may float up and down a little bit, but bear in mind that if there's a very hot summer, for example, when they use a lot of energy, what the decoupling mechanism would do is actually lower the rate a little bit, and it has the effect of tending to stabilize customer bills over time rather than cause them to be more volatile. But the main point I think you're getting at is that it removes a disincentive on the utility's part toward efficiency by their customers. It makes them at least neutral. There also are additional mechanisms you could apply that would provide a positive incentive for efficiency. That's something that California is doing now after having had decoupling in place for most of the last 20 years. And Cheryl, I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Well, I'd like to mention that we decoupled our gas rates several years back. It's in our tariff as Rider 8, if you're interested in looking up some tariff language. On the electric side, Rider 25 was put into place recently. And it was our goal in working with our commission to get Rider 25 for electricity in place so that we could remove any disincentive from our conservation programs. We wanted to support the Empower Maryland goals and reach the 15%, but not take a 15% hit on our distribution rates.
I want to just add one more thing to this, because if you're not familiar with decoupling, it's a little bit weird because it's because of the rate-making mechanisms that are in place and because of the way utilities recover the fixed costs. So in the end, it's just a true-up mechanism to sort of make the utilities whole in terms of their revenue and to remove a disincentive to save energy. But it's really, in a sense, a response to the way rates are set, which just have a variable component in fixed cost recovery. So it's a way to deal with that.
Hi, my name is Qijian Yang. I'm from Duke University. I've been looking at several type of grid-type battery technology, and from what I read that, like a sodium sulfur battery or some flow battery, they usually cost about 10 to 20 cents per kilowatt hour to sell electricity. And when I look at the price that utility pay for demand response, the price between the price they pay for demand response and the off-peak price is often over 50 cents or even over $1 per kilowatt hour. So I wonder why utility don't just install battery rather than having demand response. And a related question is that there are a lot of discussion about using property in hybrid to sell electricity back into the grid. That essentially is to use the lithium battery in the plug-in hybrid as grid-type battery. And compared to other grid-type battery, lithium battery is much more expensive. If other battery cannot compete, how can we expect lithium battery to compete?
Battery technology. Jeff.
I can talk a little bit about that. I think I missed the very end of your question, but I guess the answer is it is starting to happen. There's a number of projects going on looking at storage throughout different parts of the grid. Grid scale, community level, and distributed storage, as we were talking a little bit about earlier. And the battery prices and technology, prices are coming way down, in part fueled by development of batteries for electric vehicles. And the technologies are improving. So I would say that we're aware of more than a dozen pilots around the country, a couple that we're involved in using, for example, a couple of 1 megawatt sodium sulfur batteries that would be co-located next to a wind farm so that you could firm wind as a resource that would be predictable and reliable for the utility. And you're starting to see more and more of those type projects. You're also seeing community energy storage battery technologies that would be more like 500 kilowatt type pad-mounted devices that would help provide backup and ancillary services for a number of homes. So it is starting to happen, and again, that's really being driven, I think, by advances in battery technology, as well as the cost coming down, and also I think recognition that there's a lot of benefits in addition to load shaping and shifting that the utility can benefit from, like ancillary services.
One last question.
Thank you. David Girard from the Rockefeller Foundation. For full disclosure, I'm on the board of advisors for GridPoint. So, but anyway.
I didn't stack the audience, I swear.
My question really relates to the bridge between this conversation and the previous one, the smart grid at the distribution level and the national backbone grid. It's clear that the technological capabilities we have now in terms of being able to get a very granular sense in space, in time, by customer load, by customer class, exactly how energy is being consumed and produced if you have distributed systems. Google has some phenomenal technology that's yet to be announced, which I got a preview of a couple of weeks ago, a huge, prodigious enhancement of Google Map that has enormous applications, I think, to both smart grid and the smart national grid. How do you then, from your perspective, see the case for transmission as emerging from this very rich, very disaggregated information base that one now has on customer consumption? Because clearly now one has powerful tools for load forecasting as well that one didn't have before because of the capabilities. So what kind of conversation is taking place, especially like for folks like Rick, between regulators at the state level and FERC on how to make the case for long-distance high-voltage transmission?
From the earlier panel, I think you probably heard Chuck Gray, who's the executive director of NARUC, say that obviously there are different viewpoints you're going to hear from different states, and it's very much a live conversation, certainly within NARUC, given the have-not versus have states and so on. It tends to break down that way, but I think there are a lot of state regulators and as well as at FERC, and you heard John Wellinghoff this morning, who are interested in taking a broad view of this and recognizing that with rapid changes in technology, the whole way we look at all of these things is changing. I mean, I've been hearing people say, for example, that as some of these smart grid technologies emerge, the distinction between wholesale and retail parts of the business are beginning to blur. And that's going to create a big policy challenge, because at least up until now, we've had a fairly bright line between retail and wholesale. In fact, retail electricity is purely in the purview of the states. Wholesale is purely within FERC. And there's no secret that in recent years, there have been more and more circumstances where we've, been talking about how to keep from stepping on each other's toes, and that seems to happen more and more often. So I'm not sure I really answered your question, other than to say I think this is something that is on our minds as regulators, and there will be more and more of these kinds of questions coming up.
Lisa, did you want to? Because I'm going to say what I said to you before, if you don't jump in.
You can talk.
We were having a little conversation before about how, from an economist's perspective, thinking in terms of sort of economic efficiency and the theoretical construct of maximizing social welfare, the thought about building transmission when prices and values are so opaque to the end user, isn't that just putting the cart before the horse? Yeah, and that the granularity that you referred to very insightfully, I think, is exactly what's going to enable, and dynamic pricing combined
enable us to, as consumers, to reveal our preferences in ways that have dramatic implications for massive and expensive nationwide infrastructure investment. And so I think looking at the consumer preferences and working into transmission as opposed to the kind of producer-oriented, top-down way that we have been doing for the past century in this industry is, is my take on it. But as Rick says, the conversation's going on. And we're past our time, so please join me in thanking our excellent panelists.
I completely made mincemeat out of my notes here today, and I thought I knew what I was going to say. But I think as I've listened to this conversation, I was struck by how well this fits into this large frame that we like to apply to these sticky areas of policy, which is lead, empower, and maximize. When we talk about leading, I think we heard from the beginning that we do need the federal government to be really engaged in this issue. This is something that does I think merit national priority, and the federal government really does need to be present in this issue. We heard from the chairman about expanded FERC authority for planning, siting, cost allocation. I think a lot of those details are emerging. Some of that I think we heard answers to. Some of it I think, that are still to be determined. We still kind of need, I think, this national plan for the transmission lines. The first panel also called on the federal government to lead in other areas. We talked about carbon reduction, for example, and then allow innovation to occur at the state and metropolitan level. So, related to that, I think leadership also means having the federal government get out of the way in certain areas. And it's not going to do everything. We don't want the federal government completely present, like this notion of the federal government being a backstop in these planning, siting, and cost allocation areas I thought was very, very interesting. But empowering also means not picking winners and losers. I thought that was a very interesting part of the conversation as well. In terms of maximizing, I think the whole third panel really was about maximizing. How do we really get the best bang for the buck from this investment? It's all about getting the incentives right. Cheryl talked about what they do in Maryland when you get the right kind of incentives. Pricing is a huge piece of maximizing the smart grid. That might be intuitive to a lot of folks, but I really was struck by that as being a very key part of the conversation. We heard this in connection with the electric vehicles piece, which I thought was really just fascinating as well. And Scott's piece about information I thought was right on as well. So, that's probably a corruption of the really rich conversation that happened here today. You probably have your own takeaways. But this is an area where we plan to get into much deeper at the Metropolitan Policy Program. Clearly, I think there's more to do, but this discussion really teed that up very well. I have tons and tons of questions and places I think we need to go with this. So as this evolves, please stay engaged with us at the Metro Program. Please stay engaged with the Energy Security Initiative. So in closing, let me just thank the Rockefeller and the Cerdna Foundations for their support of our Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative and also the members of the Metropolitan Leadership Council for their support of our overall program. Let me especially recognize Amelia Estrade for helping organize the event along with Lee Rosenbaum. And for providing the intellectual support and the enthusiasm for pulling this together. I thought the enthusiasm in this room was palpable today, and that was great. Thank you all for sticking around. Have a great day. Have a great afternoon. Have a great weekend.